Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. When will the Iraq War really be over? And will our eventual exit from active military engagement there leave the country stable enough to prosper on its own? Although he has moved on from his post as commanding general of the multinational force in Iraq, the influence of General David Petraeus remains strong in the country, not simply because he now oversees U.S. Central Command. Petraeus' vision of war as a political as much as a military challenge helped redirect the efforts of U.S. troops on the ground and led to stronger partnerships between both the Departments of State and Defense and between U.S. and Iraqi officials. Linda Robinson is here to talk about it. She has covered the war since its earliest days as senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, and now she is author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. And her book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. Linda, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
You describe the book as the story of a war turned around. Did you think, say, 3 years ago that you would be able to write this kind of story?
Absolutely not. I was there in the summer of 06, and the country was coming apart. And some people were quite frank about that, including one of the generals there, Pete Corelli, and I was at his house for dinner at Camp Victory, the main military base. And he was literally tearing his hair out. He knew the war was being lost. The Shia militias were rampaging through Baghdad. There was a real campaign of sectarian cleansing going on, and the Sunnis' backs were to the wall. I mean, it was really as bad as any war I've ever seen, and I think approximated certainly the violence of Vietnam that our troops were experiencing.
We get the sense reading the book that although General Petraeus is a very good commander and a very good leader, he's really a great thinker. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, he's obviously got a PhD from Princeton, which is often mentioned in his biography, and he's often referred to as a scholar soldier. But what I found very interesting is that he gathers around him smart people. And I think that's a sign of intelligence and an astute leader. He did that in the writing of the counterinsurgency manual, which he did before he returned to Iraq as the commander. And he gathered all of the counterinsurgency experts that he could find, including a number of human rights experts. A few of us journalists came and had a three-day conference to hash over the first draft of the manual. He did that very same thing when he got back to Iraq. He gathered a group of experts, multinational, multidisciplinary group of experts, and let them alone for 3 months to study the problem and assess the current state of the war, even while Baghdad was coming apart. But he felt it was very important to have that kind of in-depth, holistic assessment. And they came up with a few very critical conclusions. One was that the war was, in fact, primarily a civil war, and secondly, the only way out was to pursue political accommodation. And he embraced those in the writing of the Joint Campaign Plan, which actually mapped out how they were going to proceed with the surge.
Can you go back and talk for a minute about the counterinsurgency field manual? Because, of course, they change each time they're republished, but this one was vastly different from anything that had come before it. Can you speak a little bit about the approach that he took in that?
Yes. Well, the main point about the counterinsurgency manual was that it had not been revised since 20 years prior, in the middle of the Central American Wars, which some people are old enough to remember. And so there literally had been a lot of forgetting. Counterinsurgency wasn't being taught, and it wasn't a focus of the military education. So he undertook to revise it, bring it up to date, but also look back at some of those lessons from Vietnam, Malaya, Central America. And they came up with the first chapter is, I think, the best one to read, because there are a series of paradoxes and aphorisms that really encapsulate the difficult, delicate business of counterinsurgency. And one of his favorite that he coined was, your best ammunition isn't bullets, it's money. And he was famous in his first tour in Mosul for having encouraged the spending of these, what were called SERP dollars, the Commander's Emergency Response Program. And that helped the soldiers provide some immediate relief to neighborhoods, build wells, repair clinics, schools, and so forth. But he also was very astute about the politics, and the politics in each conflict are different. In the case of Iraq, he realized from his time in Mosul once again that the country is a mosaic, and that you have to really understand what each of the component communities is after. And in the case of the Sunnis, we had largely disenfranchised them. He really opposed the de-Ba'athification process that was being implanted from Jerry Bremer, from the Coalition Provisional Authority. And he fought back against that, but he was overruled. And that was really, if you could sum up what 2007, 2008 was, it was an attempt to undo our most serious errors of 2003 to 2006.
Some of the things that started to change under General Petraeus is that in much greater numbers, soldiers were leaving the bases where they had been stationed and being in within communities among Iraqis. Can you talk about what started to change in Iraq as that happened? And you talked a little bit about building things, but they were actually living in among these people.
That's right. One of the key things that made the surge work wasn't just the numbers of soldiers, it was how they were used. And a key part of it is, as you say, the dispersion of the soldiers out into the neighborhoods, out into what were called joint security stations or combat outposts. There had been a few of them before, but he really blanketed the city with these small outposts where a platoon would live, or even a part of a platoon. They would rotate in and out on a 24-hour basis, so they would have some relief. But you had a permanent American presence in these neighborhoods to provide security to the population, but also very critically, the single most important initiative he undertook was to encourage these soldiers to reach out to insurgents and backers of insurgents and offer them a chance to come in from the cold. It was the search for the so-called reconcilable components of the insurgency. And because of the violence that had been going on in 05 and especially 06, there were a lot of Sunnis that were ready to come in from the cold. Those who had previously supported the jihadist elements, you know, the extremist Sunni religious factions that we call Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Iraqis had really become disenchanted with them, because Iraq, as I came to see so clearly, it's not a very religious country. It's not a very sectarian country. They really were bedfellows with this group because they'd been marginalized by our policies and by the Shia government. So Petraeus offered them a chance to come in from the cold. And after what they'd been through in the past couple of years, 100,000 Iraqis were ready to sign up for the program that became known as the Sons of Iraq.
My guest is Linda Robinson. We're talking about her new book, Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. The enactment of the troop surge was no simple feat at the time that it was proposed. Many people were questioning whether we would ever get out of it, whether the additional troops would make any difference. Can you talk about how he was able to convince people who were in a position to give him funding and permission to get this done?
Well, it was the decision to send the extra troops was made before he was named to be the commander in Iraq. And there was one particular retired general, Jack Keane, who was kind of a one-man lobby in favor of going this route. I would say as an institution, the Army leadership and most uniform leaders were ready to throw in the towel. I mean, this we were at the point of losing this war. And Jack Keane played a big role in convincing people in the administration to take this radical step. So with the extra troops, Petraeus set about employing them as political peacemakers. It was how those troops were used, because if you had just sent in 30,000 more troops and used the old tactics, I'm convinced we would have had no turnaround. There would not have been a chance to win or at least exit this war in a relatively successful manner. I always emphasize we're not through the end game yet. There are some steps I'm sure we'll be talking about. But Petraeus forged his strategy. It wasn't forged in Washington, D.C. He first had this team together to analyze for 3 months, and they proposed a lot of bold measures. He took some of them in the joint campaign plan, but he, together with Ambassador Crocker, really set about this turnaround in the war.
They have a really interesting relationship that I guess was forged when they would go running together. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, Ambassador Ryan Crocker is the son of an Air Force officer. So I suppose physical fitness was part of his early regimen. But he's an avid runner as a sport. And I should say, I consider, even though General Petraeus's photo is on the cover of my book, Ryan Crocker was an integral partner in this effort. We have no one else like him in the diplomatic corps. A five-time ambassador, Middle East expert, spent all of his career out there except one tour in Washington. So he is your classic muddy boots diplomat. He really understands the region, speaks the language, and provided that in-depth expertise. He was also what I call the good cop to Petraeus's bad cop. He really played a role of gaining the trust of the various Iraqi political factions. And while Petraeus would lean pretty hard on some of them to make concessions, they could always fall back on Crocker as someone who would really understand the depths of their paranoia of the other side. I mean, the Sunni-Shia divide has very real reasons for existing, just as the Kurds have a history of absolute betrayal and suffering, not only at the hands of Saddam Hussein's regime, but also when we left them after the uprisings at the end of the Gulf War. So it was a very important partnership. Also, I should say, below the level of Ryan Crocker, he put together the real A-team in that embassy. He convinced three ambassadors to give up their posts and come work for him in Baghdad and live in trailers behind the Republican Guard Palace while Baghdad was falling apart. So he created a team of people who are willing to work through a lot of the political intricacies to forge some of the legislative compromises that were eventually passed by the Iraqi parliament. There are several more compromises that need to be forged, but those were really, to me at least, they stand as the model of how it can be done in Iraq. You just have to get behind closed doors and broker those deals and keep holding people's feet to the fire.
It's really fascinating that this enhanced interest in diplomacy happened in many ways almost backwards. It happened from Iraq and then sort of reverberated back in Washington.
Well, I think that hopefully Washington has learned the lesson. I mean, these conflicts first and foremost have to be understood as political conflicts, and all the tools of social science are just as important as the military hardware and engineering aspects of war. And I think that very much applies to what we're currently facing in Afghanistan and Pakistan. If we don't really understand the motivations of those who are fighting and those who are supporting the fighters, we can't begin to craft the right strategy. So I think right now, my concern, though, is that while our focus is changing to the AFPAC problem set, as you know, it should, we definitely need to pay attention and make an effort over there. But we can't lose the bubble on Iraq because the diplomatic political endgame has yet to play out. And we can't just leave it to the Iraqis because, frankly, they won't. They won't get there on their own.
Going back for a minute to General Petraeus, it's very interesting in the book that he was interested not only in understanding the nature of the conflict there, but really understanding the culture to probably a greater extent than a lot of people who had come before him. Can you talk about some of the things he did in order to really get that?
Well, he certainly understood, and I think he gives a few anecdotes when we were talking about this. He, when he spent his time at Princeton, he actually compared that to a foreign culture, you know, for someone coming out of the military going to an Ivy League school. And he credited it with part of his training and the flexibility of how you need to understand other people's ideas. So I think it's the kind of man he is. But he would go to these, the military calls them goat grabs, but, you know, these big feasts where you eat with your hands and dig your hand into the pile of rice. And he understood the importance of honor in that culture and how you could never, and that's why his fights with Maliki were always behind closed doors. He understood that he really had to respect and understand the sort of tribal pecking order there.
Linda Robinson is my guest. Her book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Linda Robinson. She is author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. Her book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. So let's talk for a minute about Prime Minister al-Maliki and his sort of evolution, if you can call it that, as a leader. Do you see him making positive strides in terms of his attempt to get a handle on things and to do what needs to be done?
Yes, I think he went through a really profound evolution, and primarily in the split that occurred between him and the group of Muqtada al-Sadr, parts of which had been armed and trained by Iran and was definitely on its way to having control over the city of Basra in the south, very important parts of other southern cities, and of course Sadr City in Baghdad, a very important nationalist movement. But the funding and arming by Iran was a real problem. And Maliki went repeatedly to Iran. Iran said, we'll stop doing it. They never really acknowledged they had been doing it. Then the last straw for him was in August 07 when Sadr forces were engaged in a firefight, initiated an attack in Karbala just as about a million pilgrims were descending on the city. And Maliki said, that's it. Went in a convoy down to Karbala and personally led the offensive against them. And that was a precursor to the 2008 offensive in Basra, where the Sadrist forces were cleared out of the city and the ports area that they'd taken control of. So that split really paved the way in the first instance for the Sadr ceasefire, but also for Maliki to really see that Iran had been meddling despite its promises to him. And that is one thing that is, in my view, important for us to remember about Iraq. It does not want to be the 51st state of Iran. While there are historic linkages of culture with the Shia population, a lot of trade influences, and Iran will always have some role in the politics of Iraq, but Iraq does not want to be dominated, and that is why Maliki really does rely on the U.S. to provide that counterweight. Is he tempted, however, by the winner-take-all scenario? Absolutely. And there are some figures around him who are very overconfident about Iraq's ability to steer its future course. The reality, though, is the Iraqi military still needs a host of what are called combat enablers, air support, medevac, intelligence, all kinds of things from us. They're not ready to go it alone. And so I think that the real question going forward is, will Maliki continue to behave in a pragmatic manner? He's in talks with some of the Sunni and secular parties for a possible coalition in the upcoming parliamentary elections next January. Those parties won big in the January provincial elections, and that would be the pragmatic play. But if you see Maliki reform an Islamist-Shia coalition, then you'll know the old sectarian alliances are reemerging.
And you see it as critical that the United States communicate to Maliki that the support that he's receiving now is absolutely tied to certain actions that he takes within the country.
Yes, and I think that was really a big part of the missing piece in 2003, 2006. We were never willing to apply a policy of conditionality when we had a huge amount of leverage. I mean, let's face it, the more we strengthen the Iraqi state and military, the less our leverage inevitably diminishes. We still have it. We need to use it correctly and to nudge and influence him to go in the right direction. There are a lot of people who erroneously say the war is over, the Shia have won, the Sunnis have lost. And that is just flatly incorrect. It is still somewhat on a knife's edge. And Maliki Wali has moderated. There are a lot of temptations there. Iraq is a very rich prize. And people won't compromise unless they're forced to. And I think we owe it to all of the blood and treasure we've expended there to try to make sure this end game comes out correctly. And one of the first things would be to insist that he incorporate the 20% of the sons of Iraq that he's pledged to incorporate into the Iraqi police and army. The police in particular, because a lot of these neighborhoods really would prefer to be policed by those individuals rather than the Shia-dominated Iraqi police force that now exists.
What kinds of conversations are taking place right now with regard to the balance of power between the sort of regional areas and then the centralized government?
This is one of the huge issues that's left to be resolved. Right now, the current constitution permits the formation of regions. However, the party that was espousing the creation of a super region in the south, the ISKI party, had a very poor showing in the January provincial elections. And to me, that indicated what I'd been gathering from my own reporting, which is that Iraqis do not want a overly federalized government. They still believe in a central government. They lived under one for 40 years, albeit a dictatorship, but that is what they know. They also are very concerned about an Iranian-dominated element, and ISKI is the party that is closest to Iran. And finally, it's a far more secular country than we've often painted it to be. There are religious Islamist Shia parties and Islamist Sunni parties, but I am convinced those are a minority. If you count all Iraqis, the country is much more cosmopolitan and secular than we've painted it. And a lot of our decisions enshrined those Shia Islamists in power, and they wrote that constitution to allow them to form the regions. Now, there is a certain room for federalism and support for that, but I'm talking about extreme federalism, which would increase the centrifugal forces of Iraq. The other problem that we haven't mentioned yet, of course, is the Kurd problem, where they do have a region, Kurdistan Regional Government, but it is behaving in an expansionist way right now, trying to push its boundaries out into the Arab population and out. They would like to have the city of Kirkuk as part of Kurdistan. And the only real solution, so as not to set off an Arab-Kurd war, is to give Kirkuk a special status and allow it to remain a blended city. There's no doubt that the Kurds suffered a lot under Saddam, but the answer isn't for them to undertake their own program of pushing Arabs out of their homes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Linda Robinson is my guest. Her book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. Let's go to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hello. You know, the surge seems to have been somewhat successful because of like a confluence of events. You know, we had the troops and the change of their assignment, and then you had the Sunni awakening. But I've also heard that as a result of the Civil War, there was really a purging of the neighborhoods, especially around Baghdad, and so that the Sunnis became clustered in one area, and the Shiites, pushed them out of the mixed neighborhoods. And then the Americans went in there and put up those huge, 20-foot concrete walls to keep them apart. And then the other thing that's not talked about, but Bob Woodward mentions, and of course it's this allusion to some sort of a real breakthrough in covert techniques that really enhanced the effect of the surge and really took out some of the heart of the insurgency. Could you comment on those other two things there?
Thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you very much, Bert. I will with pleasure comment on these very important points that you raise. There is no doubt that the mistakes and overreaching of al-Qaeda in Iraq really predisposed a lot of Sunnis to reject them. And, of course, the Shia militia violence was ferocious, as I've already mentioned. But if the U.S. troops had not been there dispersed and doing their peacemaking outreach, there would have been no one for those individuals, the Sunni insurgents and their supporters, to come in from the cold to. So it's very much both phenomena operating together. And unfortunately, this war has become such a political football that many people try to say it was either or. And similarly, the tactic of putting up the walls, there were a series of tactics that were implemented along with the dispersion of troops into the neighborhoods. The walls were put up to protect the markets that were just, bombings were killing hundreds of people at one shot. And also the neighborhoods that had become the bomb factories were walled in. There were biometric registries undertaken of the suspected insurgents. For the first time in the war, you had a computerized shareable database of those likely insurgents. And that led to more precise targeting of those so-called irreconcilable insurgents. And that was critical because what you had from 03 to 06 was a lot of instances where doors were kicked in repeatedly on the same house of Iraqis who had nothing to do with the insurgency. And can you imagine how much that would alienate them from the U.S. and from the occupation there? So the precision targeting of insurgents was a key factor in the turnaround. The Woodward book, I have to say, I will quote General Petraeus on this. He called it a predator's eye view of Iraq. Woodward was never in Iraq. And I have to say, while he he's relied on a lot of Washington figures for his account, I absolutely can tell you it was the outreach to the Sunnis that turned the tide of that war. What I have seen over the course of my career covering wars is you can keep killing insurgents, but they'll keep regenerating. The kill and capture is not the key part of this. You have to address the motivations of those fighting. And what Petraeus did was he opened the door for the Sunnis to have a foothold in Iraq, in the political system, in the security system, and in the economic system. And that's the beginning of the end game that he started. But it is really up to us in our end game with the new ambassador there and to the Maliki government to carry it home.
Is there a danger in misunderstanding the sort of genesis of the Sunni awakening?
Well, this, again, has become one of those soundbite or caricatured phenomena. The Sunni awakening did begin in Anbar, and it actually began, there were very early attempts, the first ones carried out by the special forces, and then later the Marines adopted it. But there were many unsuccessful attempts where tribes had come in, and then al-Qaeda in Iraq, fighters would slaughter them, slaughter their children. I mean, there was a lot of really gruesome back and forth there. But you did have the awakening phenomenon in 06 before Petraeus came in, and that much is absolutely correct. What Petraeus did with Anbar when he got there was really begin to institutionalize that phenomenon. He got the Maliki government to agree to give non-voting seats on the Anbar Provincial Council to awakening members. So that gave them a political foothold in the system. He persuaded Maliki to permit those Anbaris to join the Iraqi army with the commitment that they wouldn't be transferred outside of Anbar. And that was what had kept a lot of Sunnis from joining the army because they were afraid they'd be transferred to Shia areas and killed and left far from their families. And finally, with the help of Barham Saleh, the deputy prime minister, who in my view is the real statesman of Iraq, they funneled a lot of supplemental funding out to Anbar, which doesn't have any oil resources. And that's the key piece for Anbar, is to assure them that they can share in the economic fruits of Iraq's main oil industry. So that's really necessary to institutionalize the peace in Iraq. That model has to be applied throughout. And the provincial elections were the first step. But next January's elections are the keystone of where we're headed. Because if these parties can all get represented, I'm sorry, if all these factions can get represented in the Iraqi parliament, a coalition can form that will finally truly represent the mosaic that is Iraq.
Let's speak next to Patrick in Richardson. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. I have a question that's basically, it's one question that's kind of two parts. But the first one is, I was wondering if your guest could comment on the, it's not the location, just the status of the leader of Iraq in a leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, who's been variously described as either caught or not caught. And then also in the Dallas Morning News this morning, they quoted a senior intelligence official as saying that al-Maliki, when he heard about these photographs that they're keeping under wraps, went pale and said that it could cause such a major backlash when they do come out so as to the population of Iraq to ask for our military presence to end even sooner. And the fact that they even describe some of these pictures, and it's like, how can they, the descriptions of the pictures are already out, how can they expect to keep the pictures under wraps?
Thanks.
And what your guest would think is going to happen to Iraq when those pictures come out.
Thanks for your call.
Good. Yes, thank you. You know, there's been a lot of coverage about the pictures, and I do know that General Taguba actually debunked or denied that he had said to the London paper what he was reported to have said, and that these pictures showed rapes and so forth. And I think there is some confusion, but the bottom line is there is absolutely concern on the part of the Iraqis, any number of military leaders, to include Petraeus, of what would be the effect of another round of this. I don't know personally. I mean, we know these horrific pictures that came out in 04 did a huge amount of damage. And I frankly think in some ways people are inured. On the one hand, you might say, what's another round of the same going to do? The shock value will be less. People already know what happened. But it could certainly inflame people to attack Americans. There are certainly people attacking Americans regardless. But I just, you know, I think it's something you can argue one side or the other of. But the fact is, a lot of military leaders are saying, don't do it. You don't want to put our troops in harm's way. And the civil rights, you know, freedom of information crowd is saying, let them out. We need to have a full airing. My view is we have not dealt with that chapter of our history in an adequate way. Putting lower ranking individuals on trial while not seeking accountability at the highest levels did not send the right message in my view. But we have changed the policies, and that presumably is the most important thing going forward, that everyone knows that that is not standard operating practice. But we have to keep reiterating that message because it's a black eye. There's no doubt about it.
We'll take a break, and then we can maybe get to the second part of Patrick's question about the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. My guest is Linda Robinson. Her book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. If you want to be part of our discussion, send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here with journalist Linda Robinson. Her new book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. Just want to get once again to the second part of that question about the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Yes, my understanding is that we have not yet verified who he is. And the last that I saw is that the Iraqis were still in charge of the interrogation and so forth, and we're going to let the U.S. have access when they deemed it, you know, fit. And that's the situation we're in right now.
Has it been a flaw, do you think, of U.S. media coverage that we tend to sort of make sort of anti-heroes out of certain individuals and focus very much on whether we get them nabbed or not?
Look, that's what we've done with bin Laden, and certainly that was what happened with Abu Musab Zarqawi, right, the previous original leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And there was absolutely no follow-on effect from his capture and killing. Iraq's dynamic of civil war was already set in motion. I mean, I think that al-Qaeda in Iraq has done itself in a strategic sense by overreaching. I mean, throwing acid on women, the beheading of people, the beheading of their children, cutting off the fingers of Iraqis who smoke. And if you know Iraqis, every other Iraqi smokes. So they just took a tack that really was not bound, was not going to get them a long-term foothold in the population. However, the wrong moves by the U.S. and the wrong moves by the Iraqi government can drive people into insurgency. My guess would be they'd be far more likely to form the nationalist insurgency. And I think that fighting could break out again if the Maliki government doesn't take steps to incorporate the Sunnis at the national level as well as the provincial level. There's still a lot of fighting at the provincial level about the composition of these provincial councils, the provincial governments. There's a lot of fighting in Nineveh over where the boundaries are, and the Kurd-Arab problem is extremely important. So we've got, I think, the politics of Iraq and how they work out the various deals that have to be brokered are far more important than the killing and capture of any one individual.
Linda, setting aside even the critical issue of political access for these people, what sort of job are the Iraqis doing in terms of taking care of people who have been displaced by the war and rebuilding the infrastructure that still leaves millions of people without power for hours a day?
Yes, absolutely. There is, and I list in my book the number of steps that have to be undertaken for this end game to play out well. And the resettlement of displaced individuals is very high on the list, as is infrastructure repair. And Sunni areas were deprived of services. There was a very clear sectarian bent who received electric power, who received trash pickup, where food deliveries were permitted and not. So all of that needs to be monitored closely. People returning to their homes, you have two different problems there. One, you have the internally displaced. And secondly, you've got a huge population, 2.5 million by some counts, larger outside of the country. And those represent largely Sunnis and largely your brain drain problem, right? The upper class, the educated, and so forth. And Iraq very much needs those people to come back to lend their skills. The problem with some of the displacement is that Shia moved into Sunni areas and had nicer homes as a result. There often is no paper trail to determine who rightfully signed a lease, because some people did with lease, many, many more with no lease, and are essentially squatters. The government long term has enough resources to solve this problem. It has, you know, the third largest oil reserves in the world. Okay, so this is a situation where, with the political will, the solutions can be found. Right now, in the short term, with the price of oil down, they're facing a budget deficit. So this next year is going to be tough. And it's a critical time. I mean, the next 6 to 12 months is going to determine whether this thing unravels or not. And I hope that your listeners understand that this could go either way. And that's why I'm so vociferous about the need to pay attention to this end game, because all that has been achieved there, which is hugely dramatic, I mean, historic, we've never turned around a war that was this far lost. And we need to keep everybody's attention focused on it. And we can do that. I mean, I believe we can chew gum and walk at the same time. We can pay attention to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and we can bring the folks home from Iraq without the thing falling apart.
We'll go next to Royce City and speak with John. Hi, John.
Hello. When the surge was being debated, General Corelli made a comment. He didn't need more troops. He needed more jobs. And in the book, that's not addressed very much, but in the book, it seemed like the jobs created for the Sons of Iraq was almost as important as the increased troop strength. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I think you are right, certainly in terms of the foot soldiers. I mean, people were being paid $10 a day, which is not a princely sum, but it was better than no job at all. And I'm actually a great fan of General Peter Corelli, who was jokingly referred to as the king of sweat, sewage, water, electricity, and trash, because he understood that you needed to provide those city services to people and that it was an integral part of the counterinsurgency campaign. He did a lot during his first tour. When I first met him, he was the commander of the 1st Cavalry Division, based here in Texas, actually, and he was in charge of Baghdad and Sadr City and did a lot to bring that services to that part of the city. But the commander who followed him did not. He then repeated that mantra when he was back as the multinational corps commander and did quite a lot to reinvigorate the state-owned enterprises as another source of jobs. Because don't forget, this was a socialist economy, right? This was a state-run economy for 40 years. And unfortunately, the initial policy with regard to post-Saddam Iraq was to convert it into a free market economy. And Corelli argued vociferously against that, saying you've got to put people to work. Reinvigorate the state-owned companies is the quickest way to get them back to work while you're over the long haul introducing market reforms. And luckily, that's been the path that has been taken. And Petraeus very much supported that. They actually agree. I'd say Corelli and Petraeus probably see eye to eye on 90% of what needs to be done over there. My view, though, I've downplayed the economy in my book, partly because the politics is the complex part. I think over the long term, Iraq with its oil resources, it does need to diversify, but let's face it, very few countries in the world have the advantages that Iraq has in terms of that key resource and the ability to fund economic development. What is far more in question, I think, is whether they're going to forge a multi-sectarian and non-sectarian future for themselves.
What's the process right now for deciding how oil revenues are going to be developed and applied within the country?
Well, they have a foreign investment law, but they have not yet passed the oil, the hydrocarbons law, as they call it, because it's going to cover the gas as well. And this is a critical thing that's inhibiting the development. They are entering into some contracts, but there's no overarching legislation that would really allow foreign capital, which many people believe is the only way they're going to update and repair all of their infrastructure. We, the U.S., actually put relatively small amount, $2.5 billion of the $20 billion in reconstruction and investment money went into the oil sector. And in part, it was because everyone knew this was a hyper, you know, sensitive topic. If it was seen that somehow the U.S. was doing too much right in the oil sector, it would be interpreted in all kinds of nefarious ways. But the bottom line is it's got to happen. And I think Iraq, my guess is they are going to pursue more of a nationalist development model. They've been 40 years with a state-run economy. They're not going to turn it all over to private enterprise. They are also going to diversify. They're not only going to allow in U.S. or multinational oil companies. They're going to give part of it to the Chinese. They're going to really diversify their development program. And that's, you know, that's fine. I mean, the important point is they get on about establishing the rules of the game. And in this respect, of course, Kurdistan went running ahead and had oil leases let already. But they have to still pump the oil out through the national government's oil pipeline infrastructure. So once again, my view on Kurdistan is they know in their heart of hearts, they know they can't go their own way. Their future, for better or worse, is lashed to the success of the Arab part of Iraq. If they were to try to pursue their own state at this point, it would mean certain war with Turkey. And they know, we have made it clear to them, which side of that fight we'd be on. We would back Turkey over Kurdistan. What is required, though, is a lot more aggressive diplomacy to try to get the status of Kirkuk resolved and to try to get some of the Kurdistan expansionist moves back in the box. And that really, this could be a serious flashpoint. So it's one of the four or five key things that we need to be paying attention to right now in Iraq.
Is it realistic to worry that a decade down the line when things have stabilized, if hopefully they have, that the Kurds would in fact move again for independence?
Well, I rely on the far-sighted leadership of Barham Saleh and President Jalal Talabani. And when the chips have been down, they have been willing to make compromises. I mean, the aspirations of Kurds certainly are to have their own state, but it's just not in the cards, not in this generation and probably not in the next. But who can see that far? It's just that the situation being as it is, Kurdistan would incite the worst Turkish paranoia. There's also, of course, the large Kurdish population in Iran. So it's a problem that would be beyond their ability to control. And again, they rely very much on us. We have to really separate out what is Iraqi bluster oftentimes with what is their real pragmatic bottom line. And that's why I look to Barham Saleh and Talabani to ultimately say, okay, this is the compromise we're going to have to accept. And right now they have a fair degree of autonomy enshrined in law and in the Constitution. And they will certainly protect that through any constitutional revisions. What they can't do, though, is keep pushing the boundaries.
Let's go next to Ed in Arlington. Hey, Ed.
Hi. I have a comment, somewhat lengthy. I don't want to minimize.
We're running out of time, so give us a short version if you can. Thank you.
Okay. I don't want to minimize the successes in Iraq and the importance of the contributions of Ambassador Crocker, Generals Petraeus, and Corelli. But let's not lose sight of the fact that this war was probably a war that did not need to be fought. It's been fought at the expense of more important areas of the globe, such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, and North Korea. And for the Bush administration to take credit for this success by trademarking it, branding it as something called the Surge, is a bit absurd, in that all that has been done under the guise of that is the placement of the troops that should have been there in the first place, the volume of troops that should have been there in the first place under the leadership of people that were available if the thing had been properly planned from the get-go, and if they had been employed using tactics that have ultimately succeeded as opposed to the ones that they did from the start, which were bound to fail should have been known to fail from the days of Gunga Din and the British in India, which is mainly hunkering down troops in forts and having them leave for short missions and then come back for their afternoon tea.
Ed, I appreciate it. I think we've got your point, and I want to make sure that Linda has a chance to respond.
Good. Yes, thank you, Ed. And you did hear me emphasize that this strategy was made in Baghdad. I mean, the decision in Washington was to send more troops, but absolutely the tactics and the strategy was made in Baghdad, and I make that very clear. I'm a journalist, so I just recounted what happened in the war. But I do not think it was the war to fight either. But it's irrelevant. The point is we're there. We did it. And it is incumbent upon us to achieve the best possible outcome. That is my very strongly held view. And I don't care if one is against the war or for the war. I think that it's not just a moral responsibility. That region cannot be stable unless you have internal stability in Iraq, because the Arab states around Iraq, if it goes in a Shia sectarian direction, they will constantly make trouble and they will push Iraq into the arms of Iran, and we will have a highly unstable region. Conversely, if Iraq can take the steps to incorporate the Sunnis into the political and economic life of the country, then there will be far less incentive for Iraq to get into an Iran-Iraq alliance that makes the entire region so nervous. So we have to think pragmatically here, and I'm not talking about any more combat role for U.S. troops. We need to be there as something of a security blanket. I think the president's drawdown plan is prudent, but what is missing is a full understanding of the political and diplomatic measures we must undertake to have success there.
Linda Robinson's book is called Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. Linda, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.